Not really, but
good morning. Like to welcome everyone out. Morning. To the Bipartisan Election Advisory Committee. I am appreciative of your taking time during the holiday season. And I know folks are busy, and so some folks can't be with us. What's that? Can't hear. Steve? Because I hear myself over. What?
Maybe if you move your mic up just a little bit.
Can you hear me now? Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll use the old traditional mic so that folks can hear. I appreciate folks taking the time to be here. The reason for proceeding with something during the holiday season is to hopefully, the theory was the election would be over, although as Ms. Tierney and I know, there's apparently still a little bit going on between now and Monday with respect to an election. But we have enough of it taken care of that we can actually talk about what happened and where we need to go. But we needed to have this discussion now as we get ready for the legislative session. And obviously, there are impacts on Colorado laws and statutes that need to take place as a result of the change, and so and ballot initiatives and the experience, and so we want to kind of get folks input on some of those and actually perhaps take some votes today to say, does this make sense to go forward on this issue? We have a number of folks who are here with us, and so why don't we go ahead and start by going around the room and introducing ourselves. My name is Wayne Williams. I am the Colorado Secretary of State.
Judd Choate, the State Election Director for Colorado. There's a mic right there.
It's on. Oh, brilliant. My name is George Athanasopoulos. I have no official role here. I'm just a concerned citizen.
Matt Crane, Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder and President of the Colorado County Clerks Association.
Martha Tierney, here on behalf of the Colorado Democratic Party.
Deborah Johnson, Denver Clerk and Recorder.
Karen Goldman, Colorado Municipal League.
Jennifer Levin, Disability Law, Colorado.
Pam Bacon, Logan County Clerk and Recorder.
Elena Nunez, Colorado Common Cause.
Michael Valdez, Special District Association.
Caleb Thornton with the Colorado Secretary of State.
Brian Easton with the Denver Post.
Carolyn Tatro, Special District Association.
Jake Viano with the Denver Republican Party.
Judy Case, Denver Republican Party.
Sue Moore, Chair of the Denver Republican Party.
Carol Tone, League of Women Voters.
Jessica Campbell Swanson, Colorado Young Dems.
David Sabatos, Colorado Young Dems.
Merlin Klotz, Douglas Clerk and Recorder.
Pam Clifton with the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition.
Jesse Kerner with Let Colorado Vote.
I'm Ben Schler, staff with the Elections Division of the Secretary of State's Office.
Melissa Polk, Elections Division staff.
Lynn Bartles, Secretary of State's Office.
Tim Griesmer, also with the Secretary of State's Office.
Jennifer Morrell, Arapahoe County. Jennifer Morrell, Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder's Office.
I'm Steve Ward with the Secretary of State's Office.
I'm Patrick Boyle, I'm a lobbyist.
And we do broadcast the meetings and record them, so we do ask that if you're going to say something, although we might be able to hear you in the room, If you please wait just a second and find that mic. Appreciate folks from the public who are here today. There will be opportunities to participate in providing dialogue. Obviously, when it comes to votes or other information, the members of the Bipartisan Election Advisory Committee are the ones who vote. So it's not something where if you pack more people there, you get to vote more. There are, I guess, any questions before we begin? Just since we have some new folks with us, I appreciate you being here. And Judd.
Thank you. So the objective of today's meeting was to go over some of the legislative items which will likely arise in the upcoming session, most notably those associated with the initiatives that passed in the last election, and then a number of items that we as an organization, the department, have been prioritizing and working on in the lead up to the election and now as a consequence of the election. So our team, and my apologies to my team and to all of you, but I've been out of the office for the last 8 days at a couple of conferences, post-election conferences. So my team has been working on developing today's material so that we'll have something to work with and discuss. So I'm going to hand it over to Ben so that he can walk us through some of the different legislative initiatives we have.
Good morning, everyone. Just so you know kind of the structure of this presentation, the PowerPoint is generally organized going through the different initiatives that were passed as well as some potential legislative proposals that our office has put together. Aside from working on just general legislative proposals, obviously our office has been keeping close watch on those initiatives that pass, and we've been doing work to consider what things we may need to do both legislatively and through rules in order to implement these things. And so the slides are kind of high-level explanations of what has passed as well as the things that we'd like to do. So as I'm going through, if I gloss over something or if members of the committee have questions, feel free to stop me in mid-sentence and ask questions, or if you want to bring up an issue, definitely make sure that you stop me and we can talk about those. But let's just get started with Propositions 107 and 108. Those are the initiated measures that were passed in 2016 that have changed the way primaries are going to work in Colorado a little bit. First of all, reinstated the presidential primary. That's Proposition 107. Proposition 108 being the state primary, which both of which now will allow unaffiliated voters to participate. Kind of the main hits for Proposition 107, it will be beginning at during the next presidential cycle in 2020. It will be a election for major party candidates. So we're talking about the Republicans and Democrats in Colorado. Those will be the candidates participating in those elections. The candidates who, in order to qualify for the ballot, will have to demonstrate a fairly significant amount of, a significant amount of support across the states in order to actually participate in Colorado's primary election. Time-wise, the governor will set the primary election and is able to set that on a Tuesday no later than the third Tuesday in March of the presidential year. Affiliated voters will be mailed a ballot, as would always be the case in a primary election. Unaffiliated voters will be mailed either a single combined ballot that will contain the candidates for both the Republican and the Democratic parties, or under the law, if not practicable, the county clerk can also mail separate ballots, a separate Democratic ballot and a separate Republican ballot. Unaffiliated voters who are participating in the primary election, just like affiliated voters, are only able to vote for one political party. And so we can talk a little bit more about how that's one of the components that we're working on to determine what is the best way to facilitate unaffiliated voters only choosing to vote one side of the ballot in order to make sure that their vote counts. and the ballot may only contain votes for president and vice president, meaning the addition of this primary election does not mean that there's an additional election where folks might be able to put local issues on the ballot or anything like that. It's only a presidential primary ballot. Let's talk about 108, and then we can get into kind of the things that 107 and 108 share as far as implementation and the challenges that we see. That'll begin in 2018, and then basically everything that I talked about for the presidential election, the manner in which the county clerks will send ballots out to voters and the manner in which voters will actually cast their ballots is essentially the same. So I think that the idea behind both of these initiatives was to have the clerks run their elections in the same manner that they run other statewide elections in Colorado as mail ballot elections with voter service and polling centers, the major difference being both timing and the unaffiliated ballot. We have been working with other states that have similar provisions that do allow for unaffiliateds to participate in the primary election, most notably the state of Washington and the state of Minnesota. What I've got here on the slide is an example, and you can ignore the little green squares. Those were just from their website. I think you could hover over those with, and they had some answers to questions, and I don't know the answer to those questions, so don't ask what they are. But what you can see here is, and what we try to provide for you here, and we'll show you Washington one too, is how have these states come up with ballot layouts that would allow for someone to only vote for the Republicans, only vote for the Democrats to make sure that their ballot is counted. And here what you can see in Minnesota is that they've done their best to split the two parties as much as they possibly could, making sure that they say do not vote for candidates of more than one party. And then what's blown up there is the instructions at the top saying that the ballot contains a partisan ballot and a nonpartisan ballot, meaning that in this particular case, unlike in the presidential that we'll have in Colorado, they also had issues that folks could vote on, that everyone could vote on, and then the ones where you had to pick either partisan or nonpartisan. Washington has actually gone through a few different iterations as they've worked on what is the best way for them to facilitate unaffiliateds voting and only voting for a single candidate. As you can see here, this is also a combined ballot. It's a pretty long ballot. This was a state primary election ballot, not a presidential primary election ballot. And so on the next card, it had also nonpartisan issues on it that everyone could vote for. But as you can see, what they've done is they've basically split it up using color coding, the first being Democrat. The second, the green there, starting at the top in the third column, being Republican. Then you see they move on to Libertarian. And so what you can do is essentially you can choose to vote for either the Democrat, the Republican, or the Libertarian ticket. You can vote for all the races within each of those, but you cannot cross-vote. So if you voted for one Democratic candidate and voted for one Republican candidate, that would be an invalid ballot. The clerk would not count that ballot. And the instructions here that I won't completely read essentially are designed to let folks know to the extent possible that you can only vote for that one ballot, that one ticket. Now, the other thing that you'll see, if you look just below the big stop sign there on the ballot, they have an area where they also ask the voter to bubble in which choice that voter is making. Are you going to be choosing Democratic? Are you going to be choosing Republican? Are you going to be choosing Libertarian? That's a required component of this ballot. We actually, on Tuesday or Monday of this week, we had a fairly long discussion with the folks in Washington about that filling in that bubble component. They have moved away from that. That's not something that they include on their ballot anymore. They determined that some of their tabulation equipment couldn't actually handle that bubbling in and making that relevant to whether or not you bubbled in Democrat and then voted the Democratic line. And so they've done two things. They also have a state primary election and a presidential primary election. For the state primary election, they've moved to a top two process, which basically means that they no longer have essentially an affiliated primary ballot for the state ballot. It's the top two folks that you pick regardless of their party affiliation. And so they've eliminated a lot of the need to split these things out. They only do that for the presidential election. And so during the presidential election, what they do in order to make sure that they account for who has voted in the Republican election versus who has voted in the Democratic election when it comes to unaffiliated voters is they actually have folks make a choice on the – well, first of all, you have to make your choice on the ballot. You have to either vote for the Democrats or vote for the Republicans. And then on the ballot return envelope, because Washington is an all-mail ballot state, on the ballot return envelope, you actually indicate whether or not you intend to vote for the Republicans or whether you intend to vote for the Democrats. And so the idea behind that being that they need to be able to balance their election at the end of the day just in the same manner that we do here when we conduct the canvass. And so as soon as that voter, I believe on their ballots, it's not a checkbox, but it's actually an affirmation that says, I affirm that I voted in the Republican primary, or I affirm that I voted in the Democratic primary. When they get all of those ballots back in, they go through a manual process of separating the ballots, stack of Democratic ballots, stack of Republican ballots. And when I say ballots, what I really mean is the sealed envelopes with the ballots in them. And it's at that point that they, we call it binking in Colorado, but they actually scan a barcode that brings up the voter's record in their statewide voter registration database. And they give that voter credit for having voted either for the Republican or for the Democratic candidates in the race. And so you essentially get credit for having voted, and you are, they also mark whether or not you voted for Republicans or Democrats so that they can track that at the end during the canvass process in order to make sure that they know how many people voted in the Democratic race, how many people voted in the Republican race. Once they've done that, they then separate those, or they keep those envelopes in separate piles, and they move on to the separation phase where, as I think probably all the members of the committee have seen, when the counties actually separate ballots that are in secrecy sleeves from the envelopes, making those ballots then anonymous, removing any indication of who voted, and then just putting those ballots in stacks ready for tabulation. Their last manual process is then to review each one of the ballots in those stacks to make sure that in the Republican stack, all of the folks who said, I voted Republican, actually did vote Republican and didn't either leave it blank or vote the Republican ballot. And when the judges are reviewing those stacks, and if you look in the Republican stack and you see that someone voted Democrat, that becomes an invalid ballot, and that's a ballot that the clerk will not count. And because it's become separated and is anonymous at that time, there's no process for cure or anything like that. And I should back up, since I said the word cure, I should back up. Washington does provide a cure process at the envelope stage. So if you return your envelope and you failed to sign either the Republican or the Democratic affirmation to indicate which ballot you voted for, the clerk and recorder will send you a letter saying you didn't indicate this, please cure this by a certain number of days after the election in order for us to be able to count your ballot.
Ben, let me interject here. One of the reasons that Washington is probably the most relevant one for us to look at is because, like Colorado, it is a predominantly mail ballot state. Minnesota has some people who vote by mail, but it is still a polling place site, whereas we and Washington are both mail ballots. And so trying to make sure that we recognize how those processes are going to work, where we protect the ability to canvass and know that the election was valid, and we also protect the anonymity of the voter at the same time on their votes, is what we're trying to balance, and I think Washington's model provides one. I should note on this that while we're talking about this, the statute as it was passed actually was very good about giving rulemaking authority to the Secretary of State, and so most of these issues on the primaries we're going to be able to deal with through rule. That's important because it allows us flexibility if the clerks suddenly say, oh my gosh, this isn't working, There's a huge problem here, and it allows us a little more flexibility than asking the governor to convene a special session if you were trying to do something that way. But just want to provide that little bit of background.
And as I mentioned before, the initiative... Sure, Martha.
Hey, Ben, I have a couple
Quick questions on Washington, if you know the answer. So if I understand it correctly, if you don't fill in one of the bubbles at the top, Democratic, Republican, or Libertarian, that also results in a spoiled ballot?
At the time, that was the case, although Washington has removed that component, and so now they're actually manually looking at the line of votes to determine whether or not you crossed over or voted whether you voted for one Democrat or one Republican. But at the time, with the bubbling process, that would have invalidated the ballot.
And follow up to that, the outside of the envelope process, is that currently there? They currently use that process?
They use that for the presidential, yes.
But not for their...
They don't use it for the state primary because they've moved from a combined ballot to just that top two, so they don't have that issue anymore.
So on the presidential, on the outside of the envelope, they have to signify which political party's primary they are voting on in the inside.
That's correct.
And how do they do that? Is it a bubble? Is it a...
As I recall, and Melissa, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's actually two separate affirmations where they sign. So you know how we sign on our ballot and you use that signature for signature verification? As opposed to having a single affirmation the way we do, there would be two sets of affirmations, each one saying either I affirm that I'm voting the Democratic ballot or I affirm that I'm voting the Republican ballot, and the placement of the signature is what they're looking for, whether or not you which of those two affidavits you signed.
And similar question to the bubbling question, if the signature is not on the outside under one of those, that's a cure process.
Correct.
Okay.
And I will say that in their first year that they implemented that process, Washington is a little different than Colorado in that no one who registers to vote actually declares a political party affiliation. That's a lot different than Colorado, where you're required to declare whether you want to be unaffiliated or a member of the party. You're still required to make that declaration. In Washington, that's not the case. And so what they found in their first year was a fairly significant number of envelopes coming back without either of those two signed, mostly because folks weren't used to the idea of affiliation. I think that's a little different in Colorado because folks are used to affiliating with a political party. Not to say that we wouldn't face an issue similar to that where we would perhaps want to provide some sort of a cure process. Matt.
Thanks, Ben. And this might be a question for Dwight, too. With the new uniform voting system that's coming, I know Dominion is working on some programming to be able to help facilitate these new initiatives. Will that get rid of counties having to go through and sort out by hand if somebody, let's say if Ben goes and marks a D in an R contest, will the system automatically be able to outstack that?
Yeah, Dominion is submitting the next iteration of its voting system for certification. We have been talking to them about this issue for a couple months. The system contains the logic to be able to basically, it's not an overvote, it's a crossover vote, and it would reject the ballot as invalid. Or actually, in Dominion parlance, it would probably force that ballot to digital adjudication. So that could be, you know, people could look at that. The one thing, so the logic of the system will enable automated tabulation of the ballots according to these rules. The one thing the system cannot do, of course, is verify that the votes on the enclosed ballot are consistent with an affirmation or declaration on the outside of the return envelope.
And just to speak to that issue that Dwight brought up there, you know, we still do have, we have options, right? We've not settled as the Secretary of State's office hasn't settled on any particular option yet. While the initiative does say, unaffiliates will be mailed a combined ballot, It also says if that's not practicable, you can also mail separate ballots. So we've had discussions about things like, you know, you get a single ballot packet in the mail, but that ballot packet includes two separate ballots, a Republican ballot and a Democratic ballot, and those are signified, for example, by completely different colored paper, so that as opposed to a checkbox on the outside of the envelope, perhaps you have a window on the envelope so that when the voter folds that ballot and puts it back into the envelope, you can see this is a red ballot, this is a blue ballot, and that's how the clerk would then make that that's how the clerk would signify that in the voter's record. You're going to always have to receive those ballots into SCORE. It is going to be a manual process. You're going to have to mouse click, you know, at least at this early stage. You're going to have to be mouse clicking in SCORE. Yes, they voted Democrat, or yes, they voted Republican. I don't think that that's something we can initially get around with technology, but I do think that we can think dynamically about what the best process in Colorado would be for making sure that that we can properly balance.
And let me just talk a little bit about timing issues. Obviously, this doesn't take place until 2018, but our clerks don't wake up on June 1st of 2018 and say, I should buy envelopes. I should... And so our goal in the rulemaking process is to hopefully get a lot of this at least done preliminarily by the summer, because clerks have to submit budgets to their county commissioners typically in the July timeframe. And so we want to at least have preliminary rules for them to look at so they can assess how much is this going to cost, because obviously – going into the commission with, well, I'll need more judges and I'll need to do some manual review, but I don't know how much, isn't terribly useful. And so that's kind of why we're pushing this now, to say we need to have some guidance for the clerks out by this summer, so when they're budgeting with their commissioners, they're not caught in a situation of you know, a year from now, being in an election and saying, well, I have no more budget to process ballots, so I'm done. And you know, we can't be in that situation. So that's kind of the time frame, and why it's – because some people may be saying, why are you waiting now? Why are you doing it now? You got a whole year to figure this out. And the answer is no, we don't. We need to have processes in place by the time the clerks are putting together their budgets this summer. Because those budgets get approved in November, and just for those not familiar with the budget time frame, that election is in the following November, so all of that needs to be done this summer. And so that's the reason for the process and why we're going this way, so that folks know. I will tell you that the rules that come out, we anticipate, in order to facilitate the canvass, are also going to allow parties, candidates, others to obtain lists of who voted in which party's primary. So long term, the extra cost from campaigning to unaffiliates, you'll be able to at least target those who are likely to vote in your party. But of course, what they did 2 years ago has no force of what they can do going forward.
I think Dwight Shellman has something to add there.
I just wanted to add one more thing. Obviously, there are two very different aspects about this. One is the ability of the tabulation system to deal with the logic to essentially invalidate a crossover vote. As I said, we will be there with the next version of the Dominion. The other issue is how to automate, if possible, the reception of the mail ballot envelope, on which the voter will say, I am voting this party or this party. And in connection with that, we have probably a dozen or 14 counties now that use automated mail ballot return sorting equipment. Some of those also use an automated signature verification software. There are three principal providers of those systems in Colorado, and I just wanted to mention that we are reaching out to them to see if they have any ideas on how we can you know, Washington obviously opted for a very manual process for doing this. That to us is not ideal. So we want to see what other technology is out there. And we are told that at least one of the providers has come up with some kind of solution, and we'd like to see what that is, just so, because the counties that use this equipment have spent a lot of money on this equipment. We'd rather them be able to acquire an add-on component as opposed to replacing their existing equipment. So we'll keep you posted on that.
So as you can tell from this discussion, although these were propositions, which is helpful to us because that meant that they were amending statute, and therefore they were able to put a significant amount of detail into the statute. So we don't have to go through and go for some sort of, you know, major implementation legislation. As the Secretary said, our attempt here is going to be to try to fix the issues through rule. And our main issue here is with how do we deal with a combined ballot, how do we deal with unaffiliateds voting and making that selection. And we'll certainly be working with the clerks, especially those who have the, you know, envelope sorters, Arapahoe County and Denver and those other counties that have those, in order to make sure that we come up with processes that, that hopefully work for the clerks. I think that the nature of the propositions makes it so that this is going to be a time intensive process, and that's just something we're going to have to work out in order to figure out as many efficiencies as we can. We already talked about our rulemaking authority, which is fairly broad under these statutes. The other component, and I'm going to let actually looks like Tim Griesmer at a perfect time left here, but let me talk about the funding component of these initiatives, and particularly I'm going to talk about what are in the initiatives or what are in a statute now with regard to funding. First of all, we obviously have the fiscal note that the Secretary of State's office put on this, which is, you know, implementing or, you know, updating SCORE and all of those types of things. So there's those costs, some that are ongoing, some that are fixed costs just for implementing these in the outset to make sure that it works through SCORE. The presidential primary statute, so Proposition 107, it essentially contained the same formula, or it referenced the formula that we use now for reimbursing county clerks whenever there's a statewide ballot issue on the ballot, and that is essentially that counties with 10,000 or fewer active registered voters are going to receive reimbursement from the state at 90 cents per active voter, and then counties with more than 10,000.
And actually it says for those who participate in the primary, so it's not even active voter. So it's a very small reimbursement, because typically you have nowhere, you don't even have half the people participate in a primary.
Right. So I think that our office has essentially said that we're, you know, even under this formula, that leaves the counties with somewhere around, you know, I think 2/3 or so of the cost of the election, if not more than that. We have other thoughts on funding, which I think the Secretary seems poised to fill you in on, so I'll shut up.
So in briefing the Joint Budget Committee, as Representative Pabon's aware, since he's joined us, thank you, sir. I know it's busy for folks. And also in speaking with the county commissioners, it is the position of the Secretary of State's office that the presidential primary should be funded by the state general fund as opposed to counties. As has been explained, there are no local issues on the presidential primary ballot. It is only a presidential election, which is a statewide interest. And so it's my belief, you know, the estimates that are out there, and some of this is based on some old data, is it cost about $5 to $7 million. The reimbursement of, if you assume 1 million people vote, and remember in a coordinated election, which is probably our closest basis for looking at, you had 1.4 million people vote the last coordinated election. Primaries tend to have lower turnout. So if a million people voted, because my math is easier, and we presume that most people live in the 80 cents counties, but we'll fudge it and call it the 90 cents, you wind up with a 900,000 reimbursement. So it covers virtually somewhere in the neighborhood of a seventh of the cost. And when I see some of the large counties here, you can handle it. But smaller counties can't. And I emphasize this because the cost per voter is significantly higher in small counties. And you can look at ACE, which is on our website, it's the Accountability in Colorado Elections. Large counties are able to take advantage of efficiencies of scale, and small counties can't do that. And so the cost per voter winds up being not just a few, not just 10 cents more as the formula contemplates, but 10 times as much in our smaller counties. So this is the legislative item that I think we are going to try to pursue and see if the General Assembly is willing to make that commitment. Obviously, it's not, they don't have to fund it this year, but this is the legislative component of where I want to go with respect to 107. And I don't know, do you have any thoughts?
I'm turning to that.
Yeah, no, I think obviously there's some large competing priorities here, and talking about this in this cycle, I think in this session is yet another reason to talk about it early on, so that there can be some planning done ahead. And, you know, I think ultimately we're going to have to cut something in order to, you know, if you just do the math and you figure out what the budget is this year and you see what it is next year, in order to accommodate this new system, something's going to have to be cut. I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure if the voters contemplated that when they approved this new system, but we've got to message that and think through that together.
Thanks. I think one of the arguments, by the way, that was made is that would generate a lot of ad revenue and other things, which is really realized in terms of state income revenue, hopefully that covers it theoretically, but who knows at this stage? That's really projecting. So I guess one of the questions I want to ask public and members of the committee are, what are your thoughts? Does that make sense, or should we stick it to the counties? Matt, you want to respond to that first?
Hi, Matt Corrine, Arapahoe County Clerk. One point of clarification, and we're still running the numbers to see, but I think your estimates of it covering a third of the costs are a little bit high.
Seven.
What's that?
I said a seventh. Ben said a third. I think he's off.
Oh, yeah, I think right
now, I stand corrected.
It may be about 15% of the cost, and that's before we figure out processing and that kind of thing. But, no, I think it'll be difficult for large counties as well, as I look at Deb, and we're kind of shaking our head with all of the budget constraints our counties have right now. But as the president of the association, I think Pam can talk to this as well, too. But we are very concerned about the effects of this on the small and medium-sized counties. So anything that we can do to close that gap, I think, would be welcomed by the association.
Aside for the rate factor, I'm really disturbed that it only really reimburses for the ballots returned. Because it costs to send it. We can't select who's going to return a ballot when we send them out. We have 100% cost in sending out the ballots. And so I think that piece needs to be redirected if possible.
So in preparation for this meeting and some other meetings we've had internally about this, I went back and pulled the primary turnout numbers from this year from all of the states that were sort of comparable running systems that made some sense. And they ranged from as high as around 50% to as low as around 20%. And they were in the, you know, 35-ish range, where that was about the average, maybe about a third of the active voter registration database turned out for that election or voted a ballot in that election, so which would correspond very closely to what we're calculating and would make it just slightly less interesting to the public than a coordinated election, but very much on par with a coordinated election. So so I think that that's a very fair calculation, and it is based on what we see nationally across several different states that are comparable.
And I'll add to that, that means for the counties, as you budget, the amount of reimbursement you get very much depends upon whether people vote in that particular election or not. And so if you have a high turnout election, you'll get better reimbursement than a low turnout. But when you're budgeting a year and a half ahead of time, you have no idea how competitive the various primaries are going to be and whether, you know, is the incumbent going to run for reelection? If, you know, when Representative DeGette chooses to not run for reelection, I think you'll have a very robust primary in Denver. But knowing that a year and a half of time, you're probably not going to know. So that's the other problem with the formula as it's set up. Any other comments or items on that before we move on to the next item? Does anyone, and I'm not trying to bind Representative Pavone here, does anyone object to pursuing this office pursuing a request for state funding for the presidential primary? Okay, thanks. Matt?
Wayne, I'm sorry, sir. And I don't know if this is the next part of the conversation, but I just want to make sure that we don't lose sight of the funding gap that we have for the June primaries as well, and we need to do something to bridge that gap as well.
So there is right now no funding at all for the June primary for the counties from the state. Zero funding. Obviously, there are increased costs as a result of this, and these are costs that occur every 2 years, not just every four. And I guess there are local races on that, so there is at least some logic. That's a bigger question, and I think it's one that is worthy of consideration. But at least as I'm hearing folks from the Joint Budget Committee, I don't know that the legislature is willing to tackle that for 2018. George.
I just have one point of clarification. So in 2020, the state and the counties will foot the bill for a primary for the presidential race, and then the parties presumably will have caucus and the assembly process, and then the state and the counties will pay for a second primary bill, or excuse me, primary ballot to go out for that second set of voting. Is that correct?
There will be two sets of voting in 2020.
Two sets of voting. Okay.
And the reason for that is that timing-wise, you have to be early in the presidential for it to matter. If you're in June, it's already decided. It's totally irrelevant. And unless you want to have caucuses on Thanksgiving evening, you really can't get the other process showing up because of the caucus assembly petition time frame. There are other provisions of this law that legislators may be addressing, such as the winner-take-all nature of the primary, which contradicts some party bylaws in some cases or some national rules. And there may be some lawsuits and others, and I'm not asking Martha or the Republican Party to divulge what their plans are there. We're not planning on taking the lead on those issues, but on the funding for our counties, that's something we are planning on trying to take a lead on.
One more quick thing. I would respectfully request that as we go through, and I know we have a lot to talk about in terms of ballot design, so on and so forth, And I understand the party's desires, completely understand the party's desires to get the ability to track who votes which direction. I would just say that this really brings back into focus, though, the need to continuing to discuss cost and reimbursement to counties, because all of these things we need to do to be able to track this information will only drive up the cost of the elections. And when we look at the cost of mailing out to unaffiliated voters, we did a quick swag before the meeting today. It's an additional $153,000 to Arapahoe County. And so that's before we consider anything else with ballot design, anything else. So we really, really, as the association and Arapahoe County, would like to see the conversation about costs continue.
And, you know, that's only three motor vehicle techs you don't have that year. I mean, right, they are, I recognize there are costs in that, and I'm not trying to be facetious about it. I think that's a more complicated discussion because it really does change the nature of the primary if we move that way. Ben, anything else on this issue?
No, I don't think so. That's all that I had on Propositions 107 and 108, unless there are any other.
So what will the will there be in-person voting as well for these? And so we'll have VSPCs and all of that cost to factor in as well, because you'll have to hire election judges and all of that. And then
yes.
Will the formula, I know the formulas might be talked about in the session, but there'll be a formula for VSPCs and all of that as well?
There is. The primary formula is basically the number of motor vehicle offices that you have. And so it's not, it's because the clerks already have the motor vehicle offices, and most of the clerks use the motor vehicle offices, although I'm looking at Deb, who doesn't have that same access that all the others do. It doesn't have as much of the impact cost-wise, but I typically those have been pretty deserted for that first part of the process. But it's also only for 6 days plus two.
Correct.
So the Monday through Saturday and then Monday, Tuesday. So it's not a 2.5 week period.
And so then when will we be notified of, so when the, since you'll be doing the rulemaking, when will the public comment setting period or the location, the public comments for location setting be? And will that be determined then by the counties, or will that also be
the
same, kind of like a similar process to how
right.
It already is?
So we'll have rulemaking that will address the requirements of this multiple ballot. The clerks always handle the sites. Some of them do it through a budget process, and you have commissioner hearings, but you should contact your county clerk for how they're going to have that discussion. Sir?
Questions. Tell me if I'm misunderstanding something. Colorado law defines a major party as 10% in a gubernatorial election. And from 2010 to 2014, I suppose, we had three major parties in the state. If we have an instance like that again, I know there's conversation of having to kind of redo the machines and how we would read all these ballots. Would that likely require another major and potentially costly overhaul if we are jumping back and forth between how many major parties we have?
So you're correct about the formula for determining a major party. I think that we likely actually probably could accommodate, particularly for the state primary, an additional major party. The presidential primary election would likely not be affected by a third party because of the threshold required to get on the ballot as a presidential candidate. And that's that you meet under this new law, you have to meet the presidential matching fund requirements under federal law, and that says that you have to show broad support. And but they define broad support as having collected at least $5,000 from donors across at least 20 states, meaning that you've collected more than $100,000 across a wide range of states, which is definitely going to be, I think, a bar to ballot access in a single state. It would be difficult in those years you talked about. We had the American Constitution Party, which is a subset of a national party, but certainly not one that generally, I think, would be gaining that broad support across states like that.
But you do raise the issue that if a different party, the Libertarian or the Green Party, got 10%, that could indeed, because they do have more of a national following, that could cause some challenges. So I think as we visit with our vendor, as I look back at Dwight, we'll try to make it so it doesn't have to have multiple iterations for the change. But obviously it will increase the cost for the counties and increase, frankly, the voter confusion, because you saw the Minnesota ballot with one column and another column with this nice bright white space in between. And, yeah, if you've got three, there's no way to do that. So I think it's a good point.
A point of clarification, is it my understanding from some of the things I've heard here today that the Secretary of State's office is going to kick back to the courts whether or not the whole basis for 107, 108 is proper, and that was it proper for the state to allow it to go on the ballot to essentially tell a private organization who can and cannot participate in their elections, and is there currently a lawsuit?
There is not currently a lawsuit. When it gets filed, I will be the defendant in the lawsuit. So there's not yet a lawsuit. The Democratic and Republican parties are both considering to what extent state law can actually tell them how to run their organizations. And yes, it may get invalidated, or it may not. But in the meantime, we have to proceed with the law as it is and prepare for it. So that's what I'm doing, but I'm not the one who'll be the plaintiff in the case. I'm likely going to be the defendant because I'm charged with Colorado election law. Whether I like it or not, I'm the defendant. So that's the joy. And my mom gets really concerned. She called me the other day. "You're being sued?" I said, "Mom, it happens all the time." That's the way it works. So, you're welcome. Other questions on this one? So I'd say direct that question to the parties or other interested groups, and I'm not trying to put the pressure on Martha. You should talk to the people who are running to be chairs of the parties and what their plans are, and that's where the lawsuit is likely to come from. Next topic, then.
So the next topic is Amendment 71, which was also passed by the voters. That was commonly known as Raise the Bar, and that is the change to the Colorado Constitution with regard to initiative petitions that propose a change to the Colorado Constitution and creating a higher threshold for ballot access. So just real quickly on how you get on the ballot currently under Colorado law, and under statute, you need in the neighborhood of 98,000 valid signatures from registered electors in the state of Colorado in order to get on the ballot. Under the statute right now, what we do when we review those signatures that come in, or we review the information on the petitions that come in, we conduct a 5% random sample of the total number of signatures that the proponents submit. We review each line that is pulled through that 5% random sample, and if the random sample review projects that the proponents will have at least 110% of what they would need to get on the ballot, then we're going to go ahead and put you on the ballot through that random sample. And if it projects lower than that, all the way down to 90%, then we're going to conduct a line by line review. And so if you turned in 150,000 signatures, our first review would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 signatures. If you didn't meet that 110% threshold, we would then be looking at all 150,000 signatures. What Amendment 71 did is it said that if you want to propose a change to the Constitution, you're going to have to collect signatures across the entire state of Colorado, as opposed to, say, focusing your efforts in, just the metropolitan areas, Denver, Colorado Springs, Pueblo, Grand Junction, things like that. And so you are required to collect signatures equal to 2% of the registered voters in each of Colorado's 35 Senate districts. So you still have to collect your at least 98,000 signatures, and of those 98,000 signatures, you need to show that you have at least 2% of those signatures are from voters within, or not 2% of the signatures, but the signatures within that group equal at least 2% of the total number of registered voters in the 35 Senate districts. So basically what it means is that you're going to have to, you know, increase your efforts to circulate in all of the 35 Senate districts in all corners of Colorado. And then the second component of that is that once you've gotten ballot access, once you've gotten your initiative on the ballot, it also requires a bit more than a majority of 55% in order to actually pass the measure, unless the what you're proposing is simply a repeal of a constitutional provision. In that case, it requires a simple majority. So that's kind of the law that was changed. This was a constitutional amendment, so right now it sits in Article 5 of the Constitution. There is nothing in statute at this point, and so we believe that we at least we would like to have a statutory fix or statutory implementation that would allow us to continue using some form of random sample review, because we simply don't have the time to conduct line-by-line reviews under the constitutional and statutory timelines that the Secretary of State's office has to review signatures. And so we have been working with a statistician at the University of Denver in order to work through just kind of the math on this and determine whether or not we can, with a great deal of certainty, project how many signatures we would need to review in order to say, yes, these proponents have reached that 2% threshold in each one of Colorado's 35 Senate districts. We're not there yet on the math. That's something that we're working hard on right now, because we know that the legislative session is right around the corner, and this is something that we'd like to push. In the absence of being able to come up with some sort of random sample review, obviously our only next method would be to say that if proponents submit a proposal for a constitutional amendment, that we would go directly to a line-by-line, essentially, to determine whether or not they've met this new threshold under Amendment 71.
So two key issues as to why we use the sample first. And when it has gone from when it has been in that 90 to 110% where we have to go to the line by line, it has always been within a few percent. I think 5% was the outlier. So we get very close, and it saves significant money and saves significant time. So that's why we use it. Obviously, if you've got to figure out 35 different state Senate districts, it's a little bit different permutation. So that's why we're working with a statistician. This is something that needs to be done, and it needs to be done relatively quickly, because there are already hearings taking place on potential ballot measures for the 2018 ballot, in some cases 2017 and others. And by the way, I'm Wayne Williams. Lynn Bartles tells me I'm supposed to remind people that you should say your name when you're speaking, because when we're recording, it's hard for somebody listening to figure out who in the world said that. So, Ben.
This is Ben once again. And another reason for sampling, as long as you determine that the sample is accurately going to project what the proponents have brought in, is the idea that now that we have this extreme... Well, it's a very high threshold, right? I mean, this is definitely going to be a significant amount of work for anyone to put a proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot at this point. We would like to be able to know at the Secretary of State's office, without looking at every single signature, whether or not someone made the valiant effort to get to that point. And so that's why we really want to get after some sort of sampling before we spend state resources to look at every single one of these lines. I have more on the petition review process, but not specifically on Amendment 71.
So any questions on this? Merlin.
Merlin Klotz. Is there any impetus for legislation to put SIG Verify on this?
That's coming to the next discussion, actually. So this is on specifically the provisions here of the Senate districts. We have to pursue legislation because the current legislation doesn't match with the constitutional requirement. The goal is to find what that appropriate statistical random sample. We will talk about those other issues in just a second here. But first, before we proceed out this slide, yes.
Elena Nunez. I'm wondering if there are any discussions about changes to the petition format for constitutional amendments, or if the Senate district process is all going to happen on the back end. Has your office talked about that, and what are you looking at?
This is Ben Schler. We have discussed that, and I'm not quite sure. I know you're very familiar with the process and would love to get your thoughts on it. We definitely have thought about how can we get folks to organize their petitions in a manner that we can actually see that they've collected signatures from all 35 Senate districts. And one of those areas would be to require additional information on the petition form that would give us more information as to whether or not that signer or what Senate district that signer's in.
And let me follow up on that. Regardless of where you collect the petition signatures, there is no guarantee the people live in that area. They might be visiting, they might be, and if you're in the metro area, you know, who knows what Senate district the King Supers is that you go to. You may have crossed a Senate district line because there are dozens, well, that might be extreme. There are many state Senate districts, and people don't shop always where they are, so unless you're going door to door, you don't know it. So you could require individuals to write down their Senate district, but nobody knows which Senate district they live in, right? So that's unworkable. This group may have half of you who know the state Senate you live in. More of you know who your state senator is, but the number is questionable. The other way you could do it is you could require the petition circulator to look it up for each individual, and I think you'd get some resistance there. So the two front-end ways are the person says or the group says, and neither of those. So I think it is stuck a little bit on the back end.
It seems to me a simple answer would be to provide a current map of that Senate district along with each booklet of the petition so that the circulator can reference the map in speaking with a potential signer.
So if you've got the map of the Senate district, so I walk in to the, you know, I travel all around the state. I go into Walmart in Durango, and they show me the map of Alan Roberts Senate District, and I said, no, I don't live there. I live in another Senate District, but I want to sign this petition. So I don't think, and particularly if you're in the metro area, so I walk into the Target, Arapahoe, and I-25, and I have no idea, by the way, what Senate districts that's in, but I bet you lots of people stop there who don't live in that Senate District. And so, okay, thumb through these 18 maps and tell us that's the
specific to that map.
Yeah, if we could please sign under the petition under the map that matches your house. I don't know, but I'd like to figure out a way to do it. I just can't come up with a way, which is why I think, huh? I think that's why we're stuck doing it on the back end, is an answer to your original question, Elena, because. But if this group, the map would work if in some places, but not in all. And obviously the circulator is going to have to be doing some research here, right? Because if they know they need 2% from each of the 35 districts, they're going to have to be doing some checking going along. Otherwise, they're going to find out, oh, we never had anyone sign from the Smallwood district because we thought people signing in Castle Rock were in his district, and actually they were, everyone who signed at the Castle Rock Walmart was in a different district.
George Athanasopoulos. Just to be perfectly clear, Wayne, 2% of registered voters from all 35 districts to repeal, in order to put something on the ballot to repeal an amendment, is that not true, or is that true?
No, it is 2% of the vote for Colorado Secretary of State that determines it not active, and it's to put any constitutional amendment on the ballot. The 55% is required to add something but not to take it away. The 2% threshold is required for either way.
Either way. So, all right. Thank you.
So, and maybe no one turns one in, but I think we have to be prepared for the fact that people will be, and we have to be ready for it.
This is Ben Schler. Just one other thought on the, you know, how do we determine the 35 Senate district thing? As someone who's been involved in administering this process from the Secretary of State side for 6 years, one thing that we've certainly found is that the folks who are generally become the most creative are the companies who are out there doing the circulation and the folks who are employing the circulators, which some are better than others, no doubt about that. I do think that, you know, there's certainly a question as to what degree does the Secretary's office help you figure out Senate districts versus to what degree is it the circulators and the proponents' obligation to make those determinations, and that's something that I think will be subject to debate. That's all I have on that, although some of the other ballot measure or the other petition stuff certainly does touch this as well.
So let me just ask the clarification or the input question from the committee. I think we have to go forward with some implementation. We can't leave the current statute the way it is because it doesn't match. Is there anyone who disputes the need to go forward with that? Okay. Ben.
Okay. So on to what gets to Clerk Klotz's question and some other stuff, which is the other things that we have been looking at when it comes to the review procedures that we follow for initiative petitions. We have seen both in initiative petitions and very publicly during the candidate petition process in 2016 evidence of and I think eventually at least one conviction of fraud in the petition collection process. And one of the things that comes up squarely when you think about that is the fact that currently the Secretary of State's office, when reviewing signatures, signature lines on a petition, whether for a candidate petition or an initiative petition, what we are looking for is that the information provided by the voter is accurate with regard to address, where they live, and whether they're actually a registered voter. We do not compare the signature that they provide on the petition to the signature that's in the statewide voter registration database in the same way that we would compare your signature on the back of a ballot return envelope to your signature in SCORE. And so one of the things we're looking at is what is the feasibility of adding signature verification, actually reviewing those signatures to the process of signature review. There are a lot of ins and outs on that. Timing is always an issue with these things. Folks submit their petitions very often at that 3-month deadline before the next election, which gives us 30 days to review. I think folks turned in on that deadline somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 or 9 different initiative petitions on that deadline this past year, which my goodness, they all passed the random sample, and in the Secretary of State's office, we certainly thanked our lucky stars for that, because even one of those going line by line would have significantly jeopardized our time frame.
By passing the random sample, you meant either failed or passed based on the random sample.
Correct. Most of them passed the random sample, meaning it projected that they would get at least 110% of what they needed, versus two that fell short, meaning that they did not project to at least 90% of what they would get in order to trigger a line-by-line review. So we met our deadline. We were confident, based on our planning, that we would have met our deadline either way, but that certainly was a help. And so when we think about adding a new process, we're trying to think about what are the ways that we can create efficiencies with signature verification. One of those is certainly something that we've looked at over the past couple of years, and that is electronic signature collection. And there's different ways to go about that. We're working with a few companies, or we're scheduled to essentially receive demonstrations from a few companies out there who already have the technology available for that. The city and county of Denver has a pretty cool app that we have we've test driven a few times that is essentially an iPad application that allows you to pull up the voter's record, let them confirm that they are at the address that's in their record, let them sign with a stylus, and then actually conduct signature review with that. And I know that over the past cycle or two cycles that Denver's used that program, they've found it to be work well, and they found that those signatures that they've collected on the iPads are actually fairly accurate and something that they can match up against the voter registration file. So we're in the early stages of understanding what that technology is and what type of technology we think would be best for the Secretary of State's office, because there is no other political subdivision that has to review upwards of 150,000 signatures per. And by when I say political subdivision, I mean in Colorado. Denver's app is very cool, but they collect far fewer signatures, or candidates are required to collect far fewer signatures or proponents of measures than at the state level. And so we're looking into that. And to get back to Elena Nunez's question about what other things could we put on the petition format when it comes to the 35%. If you start to get into electronic signature collection, which means that you're actually looking at a voter's record and confirming right there that they are, that they have put in the proper information, then you can start collecting things like Senate district, or at least voter ID, so that we can easily look up Senate district. So it's something that's appealing to us. There are some potential barriers within the language of the Colorado Constitution that we are certainly looking into, but that's one of the things that we would like to pursue. The other one is really something that would help our office, would also help proponents. When you're reviewing signature lines, one of the last things that you want to do, let me back up. A petition is a collection of what we call petition sections, what circulators often call packets, each section or packet being a stapled together packet of, somewhere between 5 and 10 pages of signatures. And on the back of each one of those sections is an affidavit signed by the circulator that is notarized, where the circulator affirms, yes, I collected these signatures. I watched the people sign it. To the best of my knowledge, these folks are the people who they claim to be, and all of those good things. That's basically the check on making sure that people signed the petition, and that circulator's on the hook for having confirmed that. If a circulator makes a mistake on a circulator affidavit, or the notary, when notarizing that affidavit, makes a mistake, the dates don't match between when the notary says that the person signed and when the person indicates when they signed, various other things, then we're going to have to reject that entire section of the petition. So if you have 100 otherwise valid signature lines on a petition that we reject because we rejected the circulator affidavit, that takes your validity rate down by a significant amount. And under current law, we don't believe that we can allow proponents to cure those issues once we've received the petition. Once the petition's in our hands, it's basically, there's very little to no communication at that point with the proponents. And so we're not able to count those otherwise valid signatures when we reject something like that. We'd like to see a process, and we think that we could facilitate a process if it was allowed under the law, to cure some of those issues, particularly the simple ones. The notary left the stamp off of the notary jurat. The dates didn't match up, but, the circulator's able to go back to the notary and get that issue fixed and things like that, so that we're not, otherwise rejecting signatures from folks who actually did want to lend their support to that petition. So that's what we mean by cure procedures, basically giving ourselves a little bit more flexibility to accept as many otherwise valid signatures as possible. And then repealing unnecessary provisions, that's actually mostly, there are several provisions within Article 40 of Title I, which is the initiative petition law, that have been invalidated by either state or federal courts over the past five or six years, that continue to sit there that we do not enforce because they were invalidated by the courts. It would be great to just strike those out of the law in order to make sure that we're not confusing people who are for the first time reading those statutes.
This one's more informational than actually, because we still are in the process of looking at things, but we wanted to let people know what's going on and what our process is. So in a future meeting, we'll be talking to you a little bit more about what it is after we visit with the vendors and find out what their options are. And remember, for those of you who live in the metro area, there are parts of the state that don't have immediate Wi-Fi coverage or even cell coverage. So we've got to have, if we go electronic, we have to have a way for someone sitting on a front porch in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains to be able to sign something. So any questions on this? Okay, so I know we've got a lot of things we want to cover, so yeah, quickly. Merlin.
On the cure issue, on 71, I would be a little concerned, since it seems to be a roll of the dice whether we get the right enough a given Senate district. I would hope that there's some cure provision on that so that they could be cured if they're short on one or two Senate districts.
Yeah, so the cure of there's a deficiency in how you submitted it is a different thing, very different thing than a cure for you were just short, you just didn't have them. And so I think that's something that would significantly impact the timeline process. Thanks. Appreciate that input at this stage. So next slide, if you could.
So we can go fairly quickly through this one, because although this one took our office a lot of time, it's a fairly boring one, and it is ballot access and vacancy process cleanup provisions. The process for filling a vacancy, so during the run-up to a primary election, you know, during caucus, assembly, once candidates have been designated to be on the primary ballot, once candidates have gone through the primary and been nominated to be on the general election ballot, all those time periods, you have to have a process for filling vacancies when someone has to leave, dies, withdraws, is determined to be not qualified, things like that. There is a process. If anybody wants to read themselves to sleep tonight, read 1-4-1002, which is the statutory provision that covers it. And it is a very difficult statute to get through. We have kind of mapped it out and redrawn it in order to just identify those places where the current statute doesn't provide us with a clear answer, and provides potentially lawyers with a great thing to sue us about. We've mapped that out. We'd like to make those changes, and we think that the way we've mapped it out is less policy than it is really just nuts and bolts, and making sure that we've come up with an answer to all of the options. A couple other things within that realm. We would love to clarify when the designated election official, usually the county clerk or potentially the Secretary of State or other designated election officials, can remove an unqualified candidate from the ballot. That's something that's been litigated significantly over the past two election cycles, something we'd like to just have clarity in the law on when the clerk may do that. The candidate petition deadlines create a little bit of a bottleneck right up near the ballot certification deadline currently. We think that there's a little room in the early part of an election year to allow folks to start circulating a little bit earlier so that we can push forward the deadline to submit, so that we just have a little bit more time to review. And if there is a need for any litigation on a candidate petition, which there oftentimes is, that there's a little bit more time between the time that we declare a petition sufficient or insufficient and the time that we certify the ballot content. And then finally, I won't go through the cure procedures again because the idea behind the cure procedures that I discussed for initiated measures are the same types of things that we would like to see for candidate petitions.
So you guys saw this in this last senatorial primary where in the Republican side you had four candidates?
I think we had four. Yeah.
But four turn-in petitions.
Correct.
All near the deadline, and they have to be done sequentially. And you had some technical deficiencies that folks sued on and made the ballot with the judge saying, look, the secretary doesn't have the authority to allow cure or substantial compliance, and then the candidates sue, and the judges always let them on if they're minor technical things. So giving some ability on defined things to allow for cure is one of the proposals we have here. And this is one that we actually are going to go forward with in this legislature because we've got to get these deadlines. And I'm sitting here looking at Sue and Representative Verbone, who are on the opposite sides of, I think, two or three different vacancies in the same House district race. As everyone who was going to run against Dan mysteriously, no. But you have to have a proposal that works. And in some cases, the deadlines don't match. You have to mail a notice that isn't going to get there before the deadline for having the meeting. And so we have to clean this up. We have been working closely with the parties on this, trying to make sure that it matches their needs. And so does anyone have any questions on this? Anyone have objections with going forward to fix these issues? Okay, thanks. That was a vigorous no objection. Okay.
Excuse me, this is Ben once again. Our next is a kind of campaign finance cleanup, and I'm going to hand it off to Melissa Polk from the Elections Division because she knows more about this than I do.
Hi, this is Melissa Polk. So we have a few campaign finance provisions that we'd like to work on this year. Just starting off with clarification of the distinction between independent expenditure committees and political committees and what I think we have seen administratively some confusion amongst groups on when they qualify for one or the other and the things that trigger registration as one or the other. As you all know, independent expenditure committees are kind of a creation of legislation post Citizens United in 2010. So we'd like to see some further clarification on those distinctions to assist folks who want to participate. And similarly with LLC contributions, that's a creation of statute where we've seen in the last couple of cycles some just difficulty with understanding how that's outlined, those affirmation statements and things like that. So we'd like some clarification on those two pieces. We're also proposing some prohibitions on personal use of campaign funds. So currently in law, there is a prohibition on use of campaign funds for candidate committees, but not for other types of committees like political committees, small donor committees, things like that. So we're looking at adding other types of committees using campaign funds for any sort of personal use outside of the purpose of their committee. We also currently have a rule that electioneering communication reports must include, so this is a Secretary of State rule, that they must include a candidate, the candidate referred to in the electioneering communication. We'd like to get that rule codified in statute. We also have a couple of proposals for elimination of reports. So currently independent expenditure committees who receive donations of $1,000 or more, the individual donor has to report that donation to the independent expenditure committee, and then the independent expenditure committee also reports that they received that donation. So we'd like to, it's really a dual reporting requirement. We'd like to eliminate the individual's obligation to file the donor report because it's already being reported by the committee. We'd also like to eliminate some major contributor reports. These, for example, are, we have seen a lot of confusion with issue committees having to report major contributions prior to a primary election. Issue committees do not have issues on a primary election ballot, and so that sometimes they are caught. They may receive a $1,000 contribution within that 30-day window before a primary, and they're not thinking about it because, you know, they're just, you know, building up their war chest. There, you know, there's really no informational interest to the public. I mean, that's what the major contributor reports are for. Those are required to be filed within 24 hours. And so we really catch a lot of those committees. And that includes, I think our proposals also include candidates who are in an off year. So, you know, they're not on the ballot, but they may receive or loan themselves some money during that major contributor period. And so we're trying to eliminate us fining people for things that really aren't of an informational interest to the public and might catch them. Clarification on reporting requirements for school board candidates. So we had some legislation last year that changed reporting requirements for committees who were supporting or opposing school board candidates, but it kind of left out the candidate piece. So we'd like to get some clarification from the legislature on that. And then some procedural changes to the campaign finance complaint process. So just some technical issues on how we refer things to the Office of Administrative Courts. We've seen some oddities with attorney's fees. For instance, you know, a complainant can, if they're awarded attorney's fees, has a mechanism to collect those fees, whereas respondents don't. We'd like to make sure that that gets cleaned up. Subpoenas, we'd like to see some greater protections where an ALJ actually has to look at those subpoenas, and just a little bit more than what the current administrative process provides. And then just some quirks on collection of debt and the referral of campaign finance penalty debts to our state collection office. So does anybody have any questions about, that's a lot of stuff, but yeah, Representative Pabon.
Thank you, this is Dan Pabon. Is it your vision to have an omnibus campaign finance bill and have all these different components inside it as opposed to different issues?
That's our plan, yes.
Okay.
Or our hope, I
guess. We are working with the parties on this as well, getting input and trying to make sure that what we're trying to do, like we did with the election cleanup bill last year, is find out which of these we can get consensus on and go forward with those. And then if there are one or two of these that may not make that final one because we can't reach consensus, because obviously we're aware it's got to pass Democratic House and Republican Senate and be signed by the governor. Otherwise, we're just kind of wasting a lot of time because it's just not that exciting an issue to deal with. So that's what we're doing. But we wanted to let this group know about what we're proceeding. And I know some of you are experts in campaign finance and others of you have never dealt with it in your life and are happy with that. Any questions on this as we go forward? Yes, Elena.
This is Elena Nunez. Not a question, just wanted to thank the Secretary's office. Some of these issues are ones that we in Colorado Ethics Watch had identified and appreciate moving in this direction where we can start to work these issues out and have a cleanup bill for campaign finance the same way we do for elections. So thank you all.
Does anyone, I'm not asking for acceptance of everything on here, but does anyone object with the concept of going forward to try to address these issues? Okay. Next.
This is Ben Schlaer. The next topic is election watchers. Last year, Secretary Williams put together an election watcher advisory panel. Some of the members of this committee were on that panel, and that panel eventually made some recommendations that became a bill during the last legislative session that didn't make it. We are looking to re-up that bill this year with only very minor changes. The idea behind this bill is to essentially clarify the roles and responsibilities of election watchers during the election period, and also clarify what types of things they can and cannot see or observe, and how they're appointed, and make sure that those processes operate efficiently. So authorizing the state party chair to appoint watchers in places where there may not be local party presence, giving the clerk a little bit more time to get the lists of election watchers from the parties to make sure they have time to properly accommodate them, making sure that we know who the person is from an issue committee, making sure that if you're appointing from an issue committee, that you are actually affiliated with that issue committee before you're able to appoint watchers. Outlining the process for watchers to interact with election judges and reporting any types of discrepancies, and making sure that that there's a process where we don't have immediate animosity between election judges and election watchers, something that we've certainly seen in years past. Puts the election watcher oath that clerks already give watchers into the statute, and then finally requires a criminal background check for a fairly discreet process that watchers may want to view, which we call two-tier signature verification, which essentially is at the point where a signature on the back of a ballot envelope has been identified as one that should potentially be rejected as discrepant and is being reviewed by a bipartisan team of election judges. During that process, election judges are very often reviewing multiple signatures of the elector, as well as other confidential information that's contained in the elector's voter record. And if election watchers are going to review that process, they should, in our opinion, have the same background checks that are required of the judges who are reviewing that information. So that's the crux of that bill. I see a question directly behind the secretary there.
Jake Viano, Denver Republican Party. First, I'd like to thank the Secretary of State's office. I like all of these proposals. I do have a question about the second one, moves up the date. Could you clarify, in other words, making it sooner or later in this cycle?
Sure. So first of all, I'll say that that statute is and will continue to be, to the extent practicable, meaning that we are not stopping parties from appointing watchers throughout the process and all the way up until Election Day. But there is a statute right now that says, to the extent practicable, the party must deliver the lists of electors by the Friday before Election Day. And we'd like to move that back. I believe that the most recent version would connect it to the period of time that voter service and polling centers have to be open, and I believe it's a week or something like that before voter service and polling centers have to be open, in order to give the clerks time to get their affairs in order and make sure that they're accommodating the number of watchers that have been appointed.
Thank you for that. One last note. So we, here in Denver County, we held what in the Army we called an AAR, after action review, what went well, what went poorly, how we can improve. We submitted that to Deborah Johnson's office. I assume that she's been in contact. Oh, my apologies. Not yet. We will be. And so I'm not going to get into the minutiae of those complaints and responses, but one point I would like to get at is if the Secretary's office would consider adding a little bit more to the training along the lines of what elected officials can and cannot do, as well as comfort teams and how they relate to poll watchers, and if you can cross those lines. So that's all. Thank you.
This has been, and we're certainly willing to look at suggestions for updating that watcher training, absolutely.
I've got, this is Deborah Johnson. With the background checks, administratively, who's doing that?
Sorry, this is Ben Schler. Under the proposed statute, the party would be required to pay for and get the background check, and there are sorry, Secretary Williams.
I was going to say, just let me clarify. This is not for all watchers. And we had some issues, apparently, where some folks may not have been aware of that, and we're clarifying that. This is for the people who see the Social Security numbers, the driver's license numbers that you see on second-level review. Because you're looking at the extra documents, you know, the normal signature review, you see that we have it blocked out so you just see the signature. But when you go into the secondary and tertiary documents, all those have not been redacted. And so we're letting somebody see, frankly, information that could be used in terms of identity theft. And so we want to make sure that that information is protected. We're not trying to stop the parties from watching. In fact, the past rule was you couldn't watch second-level review. And so we've actually empowered them, but we do need that protection for the voters to whom we owe a certain amount of duty to make sure it works properly. And so we're trying to balance that out. But that's why we're trying to expand the role of the watcher, let them see some stuff they couldn't see before. But because it's confidential information that could be used for identity theft, we don't want crooks doing it. And I know each of you, both parties have awesome people who are law-abiding, but occasionally there might not be, and we need to protect the voters on that. So that's the balance. Matt.
And I think one other point of clarification, too, that's important to consider here. This is not a step. The background check is not something else that our permanent staff doesn't go through, and that our election judges who do these steps also get a background check, too. So it's just making sure it's a level playing field across the board.
Yeah. Okay. Any objection to proceeding with the watcher bill? Okay. Let me have you skip two slides ahead because I want to say the VSBC part for last. This one's, I think, a little more straightforward.
This is Ben Schlaer. So another proposal that we have here is a constitutional amendment. It's a required constitutional amendment because the language is directly in the Constitution. As you know, when you received your very large ballot this year, you saw that every time there's a judge up for retention, and there are many, that the ballot repeats the language, shall Justice so-and-so or Judge so-and-so of the whatever court be retained in office, yes, no. That requires the clerks to use up a lot of ballot real estate repeating that question. This would simply update the Constitution to allow clerks to bundle those retention questions with a single question of shall the following judges or shall the following justices be retained in office, so that you could then simply go down the list listing names rather than repeating that question.
Yeah, and just to clarify, you would still be voting individually on each judge, but you wouldn't be repeating right. The question. You see, this is probably Denver's ballot here because I see it in both English and Spanish. So
right.
Every time the question shows up, it has to be repeated in both languages if you're one of our bilingual counties. And so you've got, you know, a lot of space that's taken up, and it almost pushed Denver to how many pages, Deb?
Five.
A five-page ballot. So front, back, and another front. And frankly, to the extent, you know, we want people to look at and ponder the things that are important to ponder on the ballot. Reading the same question 25 times isn't one of those. So this is a constitutional amendment, which means to get through, we need two-thirds of the Democrats and Republicans to agree to it. And so this one I'd like to get your input on. Yeah, because it is actually going forward at a very high standard, I'd actually like to get a vote. And I'll defer to Ms. Johnson to make the vote since it was your request initially or to make the motion.
I move that the BIOC support this constitutional amendment.
So I actually think that there is some work. I think this is a good idea and the right idea. And I actually think that there's some additional work that maybe parties may be interested in doing on the judiciary side of the Constitution that may or may not fit in with this. But what I would say is, as a caveat to this, is that we talk to folks like Justice Corliss and the Bar Association and some of our friends in the legal and judicial community to see what other issues may be of interest, because if we're going to do some changes to the judicial section of the Constitution, there may be other interest in doing that and maybe combining the two. And we don't have to agree on that today, or I'm not even sure what that necessarily is, but I think it's incumbent upon us to have those conversations.
Martha.
Martha Tierney. On that same vein, have you guys done any vetting of this with the judiciary or state judicial or anybody to see if they raised any objections that
no.
you...
No, we're starting with this group, and this okay. is not a definitive yes. This is just we support going forward with the effort.
Okay. And I would just say, from my part, I don't have any concerns about it now, but I would certainly be interested in knowing if that body, that community, is raising particular concerns, and that might change my opinion. So to the extent that I might be voting here today, I reserve the right to change that vote once we do that vetting.
Well, and I think that's an important point. And I'll tell you this, that if we don't have at least non-opposition from them, I don't see how you get to two-thirds. So I agree. I mean, this is a constitutional amendment. This is not an easy thing to get on the ballot. It's hard enough to get 18 votes and 33 votes, let alone the numbers required for constitutional amendments. So with the caveat that this is contingent upon getting the judiciary's input, all in favor of proceeding with this, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Okay, it does carry unanimously. Now let's go back. Thank you for that. Let's go back to the VSPC discussion. And this one, we're set, I think, for what time, Judd?
Whatever we set, Dan. We set? 15 minutes. We've got 15 minutes left. And sometime before 11:30, we need to set the next meeting, which usually takes a couple of minutes. So I think we've got 10 minutes or so to discuss this.
And this has been Judd. I'm going to hand this off to you.
Yep. So you can see on the board the current way the law reads for the general election, for the primary election, and then this idea of what qualifies as reasonable business hours. But we did want to give you some numbers from this last election just to give you some context for understanding the way the VSPCs work during the period during a very active general election. By the way, I'll just give you some broad numbers on that. We had more people vote in this election than had ever voted in a Colorado election before. It actually, we had a higher percentage turnout both by active voters or by registered voters in the state of Colorado than any other election on record in the history of the people that have worked in this office. We were at 71.9% calculated by VEP, which is a voter eligible population. Those are the people that could have voted had they registered and participated. And then we were at about 75%. If you measured it against those who were currently registered, which was almost identical to 2008. So the 2008 bar, which has always been thought of as extraordinarily high and will be unlikely to meet it in future elections, we met it for this election, both in terms of turnout related to registered and turnout related to those who could have registered, could have participated in the populace. So it was a very big election for us, and I think it can be used as a bar to understand what would be the maximum number of participants that we would have using VSPC. So I say that with the lead in to here are some numbers from this election period that might be relevant for this discussion. So what we've done is broken down turnout or broken down the use of the VSPC for new registrations for the 22 days prior to the election and including Election Day. So for the 13 days, which began on the day that you could mail out a ballot, which was October 17th, and ending on the 29th, that was the Saturday before the Sunday where you couldn't have a VSPC open in those first 2 weeks, we had 1,271 people who registered new and then voted. During that time, we had around, so that's a 13 days, 1,271, so you're talking about 100 new registrations a day. And we had 150 VSPCs that were open during that time, approximately. Actually, just a handful fewer than that, but around 150. If you do that math, that's 0.67 new registrations per VSPC per day during those 2 weeks. Yes, Elena.
Do you want a microphone? Can you hand her that one, maybe?
This is Elena Nunez. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure I understand. So that's the period starting October 17th, which includes the week when they were not required to be open?
Yes.
So do you have it broken down from once they actually were required to be open and what those numbers look like? Because it seems like having a week when most counties didn't provide those services because they weren't required to under law, it's a little confusing to keep those two numbers straight.
Well, just clarification. Actually, most counties did provide those services during that time. Certainly all the counties that were counties where the VSPC was their county clerk's office, every one of them provided those services.
And but there wasn't a statutory requirement to, right?
Yes, but I'm just clarifying what you said. So actually all of the metros had sites open during that time. And every county had a county office that was open that could have issued a ballot during that time. So actually the number is probably about right. But you're right, statutorily they didn't have to open until 15 days prior to the election, which would be splitting that data in half. And you're right also that the number becomes higher during that following week. I don't actually have it broken down like that right now, but I can get you that data. Martha.
Martha Tierney, maybe you're getting to this, but if I heard you correctly, the statistic you just cited was just new registrants.
That's right.
So there's a lot of other services that people use at VSPCs, right? Lots of updating, lots of replacement ballots, lots of other stuff.
Sure.
Just voting in person, not registering. So do you have that data?
We do have. In fact, they're pulling and massaging that data today. Because we just closed our election on Friday of last
right.
week. So some of this data is just like totally right off the presses. But I just because I kind of understand the nature of that data, the new registrations over this period of time and the updated registrations during this period of time are very close to being, you know, very similar. The updates are just slightly higher. So this number, which I'm about to give you, encompasses around 27,000-28,000 new registrations during the 22 days. The updates are going to be in the low 30s. So we're not talking actually about a great difference in the amount of updates as compared to the news.
One more question, Martha Tierney. But you're focusing on registrations, and lots of people just like to go vote in person. So that's another number on top of that.
No doubt. And all I'm doing is giving you some numbers.
Okay.
I'm just giving you a landscape to understand activity. And you can throw out other things which complicate that, but this is really just about the landscape. So for those first 13 days, about 1,271, well, not about, which qualifies as 100 a day, and since you had 150 VSPCs open for the period, approximately, you would be talking about 0.67 new registrations per VSPC per day. That's that period. Then the next chunk of days that we're talking about would be the 6 days of the week prior to Election Day. So this would be October 31, so Halloween, to November 5th. During that period, there were 3,040 new registrations that voted. So you would be talking about approximately 500 a day. Again, we have around 150 VSPCs open, so you would be talking about 2.5 new registrations per day per VSPC. So that's the 13 days, then the 6 days. Then I'm going to talk about Monday and Tuesday of election week. on the Monday of election week, so November 7th, we had 3,011 new registrations that occurred on that one day. So that's around 3,000 a day. And we had 200 VSPCs open or thereabouts, actually a little bit more than 200. And so if you do the math, that's about 15 new registrations per VSPC per day on that day. That's the Monday prior to the election. And then on election day, we had 20,960 registrations that occurred on election day, where they registered new and then voted on that day. If you do the math, that's around 21,000 on that day. That was sarcasm. So around 21,000 on that day, and that's 266 VSPCs. The math is 79 new registrations per day per VSPC. So you can see that there's a lot of activity that occurs on election day, the day before election day, and actually that week before, there's pretty sizable activity. But in the previous week or even 2 weeks prior to that, the activity dwindles quite substantially.
I appreciate the numbers you are giving out, but it does not reflect the amount of traffic we have. I mean, like Martha was saying, I mean, there's a lot of other reasons they come into our VSPCs. And, you know, if we probably had that much traffic just in Denver. So, I mean, I don't know the relevancy at this point. If you can get us more complete data, that would be great.
So the relevancy is that it shows the nature of the use of VSPC. It doesn't. In no way am I trying to suggest to you that this is an accurate portrayal of what, you know, the activity was during the election on those particular days. It's all it is the ramp up period. So the low usage to the medium usage to the extraordinary usage.
Martha Tierney again, but only as to registration. I mean, your data is only talking about registration. So it doesn't really show usage. It just shows usage for registration in person.
So it's actually much more narrow than that. It's only new registrations. But again, it's only an idea of the way that VSPCs were used across time. There was weeks where there was little activity, then there was a week where there was medium activity, and then there were a couple of days where there were extraordinary activity.
But activity only for new registrations. Okay. That's why I think you're
okay. Let me step in.
Confusing everybody. Intentionally, maybe.
The same.
My feelings are hurt.
Okay, we're going to have more data for you. I will tell you that the numbers I've seen indicate that about 80% of the, just like happened in 2014, by the way, 80% of the people who came into the VSPC for any purpose came in on the Monday and Tuesday. 20% came in the preceding 12 days that it was open. So you have 12 days, and it's the same ramp up. The proportions are similar. You had very slight use. You then had an increased use that second week. The VSPCs were required to be open. Monday, then you have almost as much as you had the prior week, and then Tuesday it astronomically increased. And that's what you saw on election day. The relevance of this is these are people who the clerk has had, or the 79-year-old election judge is inputting all of the information, which means it takes time. And so that's the precursor for our next meeting, which we now need to schedule, because as Jed pointed out, that takes a few minutes. So I'm presuming you don't want to come back between now and Christmas, or even between now and New Year's, but I think we do need to have a discussion where we can probe into these data with all the activity. And there's really three categories: the people who voted, the people who updated a registration, the people who did a new registration. And I divide them in that category because of the amount of work involved for our clerks and judges. And we'll get you all of that data, and we won't make you write it down. We'll have it in a handout that you can do. I'd like to do that the beginning of January, because I think we need to have this in advance of the session. And so what are people's schedules like In the, let's see, the session starts on the 11th, is that right? Okay. So what time frame, let's start with this. Do you want to look at the week of New Year's or the Monday and Tuesday of the session week?
Wayne, I would just say the first week, the 4th through the 6th is JEOLC, the Election Center's legislative event in D.C.
Okay. So how is Monday afternoon, January 9th?
I have jury duty, so not
very. How is Tuesday afternoon, January 10th?
Okay, let us plan on meeting at 1:30 on Tuesday, January 10th. Does that work? I appreciate your willingness to talk about a whole lot of issues. We obviously have a lot of information. The VSBC discussion is much more involved, which is why I bumped it, because I wanted to talk about that judge issue. And we'll proceed meeting with the Bar Association and with the judges and others. I appreciate your being here. I know it took time out of your schedule. We'll see you at Matt.
I'm sorry to interrupt, sir. One quick question. How long are you thinking for that meeting? Is it 2 hours again or three?
I think that one might be a three-hour meeting. Because the VSBC discussion really is an involved discussion, and we will actually get you the data the week ahead of time so folks can look at it. As I'm looking at Ben saying, is this doable? You don't have to look at it, but we want to send it to you ahead of time so you're not being blindsided or anything else, and we'll divide it in those three categories. Is there any other category that people are wanting as I look at our clerks here that we should be providing? Seems to me, Martha?
So I don't know if you have the data in this format, but what I think would be really helpful is to understand the capacity that the VSPC could handle, because it doesn't really, a VSPC with one check-in station versus a VSPC with 10 check-in stations is a big difference. And so that, understanding that, it's not so much numbers of VSPCs that I think we should look at in terms of making any changes. It's how much capacity can those VSPCs handle and when. And I don't know if that data is available or you could gather that data, but that's the kind of data that I think would be very, very helpful.
We'll work on that. I think that is a point well taken. I would note that in the last presidential election, for example, Jefferson had eight early voting sites and El Paso had 4. But we processed twice as many voters through our 4 as they did through their 8 because we had them in malls. And so capacity, number of stations is a huge issue. And I think we'll work to see what we can gather there. Any other items? Yes, and then there. Yes.
Jake Viano, Secretary Williams, I don't know if this has been addressed by your office or not, but leading up to the election, we identified an issue with online registrations, whereby if somebody registered at an address, using their number, and then re-registered using their Social Security, and there was a potential typo in the name, and they were actually issued 2 separate ballots. And so I would like to bring that to your attention, and if you feel it's prudent to bring up in committee, I'll defer to you.
So we are working on some list maintenance issues, and there is also a bill where we're looking at the ability to merge things. There are sometimes typos that are inputted, and when the typo shows up, so if I spell Catherine with a C and Catherine with a K, they're both going to get a ballot unless the clerk review. And so we will talk about that going forward. Merlin.
Merlin Klotz. I would hope that as we look at the VSPC issue, we consider some discretion from county to county. You pointed out when you've got malls available, for example, that can handle large capacities, you've got one situation. We've got a very square county with one location's within 10 miles, 90% of our population. We could get by with one VSPC, for example, in the early location. With Adams and Arapahoe County, when they're 100 miles from east to west, they need more. And I think
the point is, I would hope that we could look at some county discretion.
I appreciate that. We will look at a number of those issues going forward, and obviously these are always, as I would contemplate it, a minimum level that clerks are free to have discussions with the Board of Commissioners about what other needs that may exist. So we're not, it's not my intent ever to say you can't have more, but I do think we need to look at what is the appropriate legislative minimum and then what decisions are made at local control, and we'll talk about that at our next meeting on January 10th at from 1:30 to 4:30. Thank you very much for your participation today.